Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Appeal, helping you enjoy your fruits and vegetables at peak freshness and reduce food waste. Learn more at appeal.com.
Welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer. Today, guess what? We're going to talk about meatpacking. I know you never hear about that from me or nothing, but actually, this is a very, very important topic. So although I may seem to have a one-track mind, and I do think a lot about the meat industry, the fact is that we should all be thinking about the meat industry. And to that end, I have back on the show with me the wonderful Amanda Hitt, who is launched the Government Accountability Project's Food Integrity Campaign, of which she is the director. And in that role, she tackles multiple issues that emerge from today's industrial food system. And in addition to that, Amanda serves on the board of directors for the Food Ingredient and Health Research Institute, as well as the International Book Bank. She is a member of both the Maryland and DC State Bar Associations. Amanda, welcome back to the show. It's always great to have you with us. This is like you've been coming on this show now for 10 years, right?
10 years? Has it really been that long?
I do think it's got to be at least nine. Most definitely, not maybe eight at the least, but certainly the better part of the decade. And many of the times that you have been on the show, we have been talking about line speeds and what used to be called the HIMP program, H-I-M-P, which I forgot to look up what the acronym means. But essentially, it was a pilot program started in the POG industry, oh, probably in the 90s, right? I mean, we're talking over 20 years with that now. Am I correct with that?
You started in poultry, actually. Piloted in poultry, and you're right, about over 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And they started a pilot program in pork as well.
Yep. So before we get busy with the pork and poultry industry line speeds and all of what's going on there, I just want you to remind listeners of what the Food Integrity Campaign does and who the Government Accountability Project is.
So starting with Government Accountability Project. So they're a 43-year-old organization. They're a whistleblower protection organization, nation's leading whistleblower protection organization, one-stop shop for all your whistleblower needs. 10 years ago, I started the Food Integrity Campaign, which is a program of Government Accountability Project. And we work specifically with whistleblowers in the food and ag industry.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so, as I said before, you and I have spoken often about the efforts of the hog, pork, and poultry industries to increase line speeds. So as you just mentioned, it goes back over 20 years with the first iteration being an effort to speed up the rapidity with which chickens are processed. And just to remind listeners who may not be familiar with this, at the moment, chickens are processed at 145 birds per minute. And what they are seeking to do industry-wide is raise that speed to 175 birds per minute. So how is this rolling out now? Why is it that all of a sudden they're getting these waivers to speed up the line speed without actually having it become a sort of industry-wide standard?
Well, it is becoming an industry-wide standard. I mean, that's essentially what the waivers have done. I mean, the waivers kept coming in and getting improved to the point where it was almost it has become the industry standard. And now there's a rulemaking to allow the a new rule for instead of hemp that you mentioned earlier, that is called the new poultry inspection system. So it's a modernization there. You were saying that 175. So if you think about that 175 birds per minute, that's giving a meat inspector a third of a second to inspect a chicken carcass, mm-hmm. a third of a second. So if you just look at it that way, you see, well, that's really absurd and we shouldn't be doing that. But then you add on to that, that not only are they increasing line speeds, as you said, which is crazy, mind blowing, but they're reducing federal inspection. So less inspectors, higher speed. I mean, I don't know how anybody could look at this and say this is a good idea for the safety of America's poultry. I also don't know how anybody could look at it and not say there's the meat industry getting that, you know, sweetheart of a rule, right? I mean, this is such an obvious privatization and a way around regulation. It's nuts.
Now, during the Obama administration, the line speeds were pretty much kept where they had been. And HIMP, which is now the new poultry inspection rule, HIMP wasn't really allowed to expand much beyond the 7 or 8 pork plants that it was in. And I don't remember how many poultry plants were able to implement it. But they kind of held the line. But suddenly, and this completely went past me, I did not see this happening, but the pork industry has now completely increased its line speed across the board. And I didn't see that even mentioned in the trades, which I normally follow with great assiduity. How did that happen? Remind me of how did I miss that?
Oh, there was this 4 years that started in 2016, and there was a president that got elected named Trump.
God, I love you, Amanda. Yeah. Yeah. So when that guy got elected, suddenly all regulations were allowed to disappear, I guess.
Well, I joke, Trump did not create it, right?
No.
But it did create that perfect deregulatory momentum and allowed for that to happen. So things happened much, you know, when Obama was in office and Vilsack, I mean, their constituents, their voters were saying no to the line speed increase, right? So it made it harder for them to do it, right? Because the very people that put them into office were saying, you know, the mothers of, you know, the suburban housewives, the whole, every sort of voting demographic, environmentalist, animal welfare, worker rights, those were the people that put Obama into office, at least to some degree, right? Like, I think we would all agree. That was not true with Trump. Trump didn't answer to those groups. And so what you saw was a very swift move to get pork deregulated.
And so that actually happened over in the last four, like prior to COVID, the pork increased line speed in the pork industry. I literally missed this completely. I'm ashamed to say.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just sort of happened. It was that perfect storm, and things just worked that way. And there wasn't a lot to stop it. You know, interestingly enough, for people who are kind of following this or even know about line speeds, I suspect they're, you know, well, no one's dead yet, you know, so, and I think listeners should understand that COVID slowed down the lines because it bottlenecked because of illness, right? So
Yes. Sometimes
these plants may have these waivers. So, you know, I was saying, oh, everybody got the waiver, or, you know, a large percentage of the plants, the poultry plants got that waiver to increase line speeds. But they, you know, they haven't been running at those high speeds. Same with the pork plants. So, you know, they're not doing all that they could just because they're not staffed up in a way that allows them to do that. So strangely enough, COVID has kind of not let us really see how potentially maybe dangerous, I think, is a safe way, you know, depending on what's getting down, you know, what making its way past the inspectors and past the workers.
Right.
Dangerous food. We don't really know how bad is yet. So not to be gloom and doom, but the reason you don't know is because it hasn't really gone into effect because of COVID, I would say.
Right. Because they are still operating at a slower rate than they were would be under normal circumstances. So, but just to explain to people what the implications of increasing the line speed are, just to make it clear for people who don't follow this or who are just tuning into the show for the first time, wanting to learn a little bit about the meat industry. The line speed is the speed at which the animals move past the workers, who each one of them makes one motion, one type of motion, one type of cut, and then it moves to the next worker. And this is a very sort of Henry Ford ergonomics type of disassembly line, if you will. So when you increase the line speed, how do you feel that is going to play out in terms of worker safety? Above and beyond, aside from the fact that they're supposed to be socially distancing these slaughterhouse workers and providing them with PPE and so forth, we'll talk about that in a minute. But what about just sort of the repetitive motion industry, the likelihood of increased injury from, you know, knife cuts or whatever? Talk about that, and also the implications for animal welfare, because that must be something to be considered as well.
Well, I think that they're very common sense, right? I mean, you're higher speeds with knife wielding workers,
right? Who are cheek by jowl,
yeah, right? Who that are packed in shoulder to shoulder, you know, and which, like you said, we'll get to later. But I mean, they're in there in an assembly line, a disassembly line, I guess, their fabrication, and they're doing repetitive motions and cuts, and you know. We talk about worker injuries. I mean, obviously, you know, the risk of amputation is quite high. It's one of the most dangerous jobs in America, poultry slaughter specifically, but all slaughter in general, because of this, again, that there's knives involved. But there's also the repetitive motion. And I think most people are aware of carpal tunnel because, you know, like, oh, I have carpal tunnel because I play Angry Birds too much and now my wrist hurts. But that's not what we're talking about here. I mean, the type of injury is lifelong, a lifetime of pain and a lifetime in injuries that are lifelong. So I'll give you an example. I had a meat inspector whistleblower tell me a story where she was standing, you know, she was looking at the line and there was a worker next to her. And she noticed that the worker was clearly in pain. I mean, she knew the worker, you know, she saw her every day. And she looked down at the worker and the worker's wrist had swollen to the same size of her hand. So it looked like one huge limb. And that's carpal tunnel in that environment. So it's many times more severe. So, you know, saying a musculoskeletal injury, we're looking at a lifetime of pain. So, and then there's amputations and lacerations. So it's high speed knife wielding is, you know, again, these are just common sense, like, well, someone's going to get hurt. And with the animal welfare, it's interesting because, you know, you know, the USDA is a proponent of this. It's their rule. It's for industry, right? But it's, they're proponents of it. And they're like, well, no, you know, animals are not going to be any more hurt or any more severely treated, in these higher speeds. But that's simply not true. I mean, they're, you know, just the transportation alone and feeding these plants with animals, like bringing these animals into the plants and ushering them, getting them in, the speed and the movement and just the size of pigs, for example. I mean, just the physical, you know, what it takes to get them moving. And there's the injuries increase with speed, but specifically with chickens, something happens there that's unique is the shackling. So high speed shackling. So the chickens are turned upside down and their legs are affixed to shackles. So that's a living bird and it's highly dangerous for the worker, but it's extremely stressful for the animals, and misshackling can lead to all kinds of unnecessary and unintended pain that happens to the chickens. So just, again, it's common sense. I mean, obviously more animals are going through the process, and so that the likelihood of injury increases.
It's stunning. And it is stunning that there has been so little headway in in dialing back some of these extraordinarily risky practices. Now, we're going to talk for a minute about PPE and stuff, because besides the impact on worker safety, the increased line speeds do nothing to allow workers to physically separate or distance from each other. And so even though companies like Tyson, Cargill et al., Smithfield, claim to have spent millions of dollars in PPE, protective personnel gear, and so and other measures to safeguard their workers, it's clear that with this one measure of increasing the line speed is going to be implicated in increased rates of disease, COVID-19, cases and deaths, not only in the plants, but in the communities at large. And I wondered if you could comment on, on that in terms of what you are seeing, especially when we start talking about your whistleblower, your most recent whistleblower case, which we are going to do.
All of this, all of my information, not all, but I'd say 80-90% of my information comes straight from the workers and the insiders themselves. And that is important to understand. I mean, this isn't my conjecture or my academic thoughts around this. This is what I'm told from people who are actually doing this work. My understanding is, every aspect of this was mishandled in the slaughter facilities. I mean, and it started with just a general not really understanding the gravity of COVID and that in its contagious nature, and that it was in fact a very real and urgent threat to workers. I mean, that it started there. So nobody reported any actual real concern about protecting workers. So you mentioned the PPE, for example, and the social distancing. That it's certainly in the beginning wasn't addressed at all.
Right.
And in fact, early reports from workers were, they were crowded together to get their temperature checked. So there was examples of that. I mean, there were photos and then, people don't realize too with workers, many times their family or relatives who live with them are also in the plant. So if someone did have a temperature, then that whole family unit would not be able to go to work for the quarantine times. That would mean very little or no income coming in for that family. So it was pretty devastating. And all of any effort to contain the virus or limit the spread was born on the workers. So the plants were, there's a case, it's not my case, but where the company, I believe it was JBS, but I could be mistaken, either way, they were making the workers pay for their own COVID tests. The shifting of the burden to the expendable humans was so obvious. It's almost like, I don't know how to say it, Katie, except none of this is new. All of the stuff I've been saying, these workers have never been anything more than an expendable resource. They are disposable like paper plates. And so anything you're seeing with COVID is just an illumination of an existing wrong. So Everything that was going wrong with the treatment of people who, there are people that mattered less. They mattered less. I mean, look at the people who have to take these jobs. I mean, a lot of them were talking about a immigrant workforce that has language obstacles there, difficulty finding jobs. Many plants specifically hired undocumented workers because they knew they could control them more and keep them quiet and keep them under their thumb. And then also a lot of people who take these positions. It's the only type of job they can get because they have a felony record. So They're not going to raise any concerns or anything. So it's a workforce that was cultivated, curated to be quiet and subordinate and subservient. And so this is all just the same stuff, different day. Mm-hmm. The only difference is now we're seeing it for real. We see how little these people are really cared about and cared for.
Right. And we also see the implications of not reducing the caseload of COVID-19 in slaughter plants and food processing facilities, because as Leah Douglas from Food and Environment Reporting Network has reported on my show for the last 6 months, there is widespread community community spread of COVID in any town in which a slaughterhouse or food processing facility exists. So yeah. Not only are these workers at risk, but the community at large, whether they work in those plants or not, are also increasingly put at risk by these very risky practices of the meat industry, which, you know, I don't have the immediate figures. I should have looked them up for this, but of course I'm speaking, you know, completely extemporaneously. But you know folks that JBS, that Smithfield, both of which are owned by foreign nationals, by the way, but operate with impunity in this country. They do whatever they want. And even the American grown companies like Tyson, Perdue et al, they are reporting record breaking profits. Their profits went up. Their exports went way up during COVID, even as they were pretending, as in the case of Tyson, even as they were pretending that the disease was going to, you know, cause food shortages in the United States. And then it turns out a few months later, we find out that their export profits are, you know, through the roof as they, you know, allow all of these, you know, cases to go completely untreated. I want to go back to one more thing about the increased line speed. Then we're going to take a break and then we're going to talk about the case that you're working on right now. But just to follow up on something, a point that you made earlier, Amanda, about inspection, about the fact that it's 1/3 of a second per bird for an inspector to be able to identify disease, fecal matter on the carcass, you know, any of the number of other things that would be considered contaminants. Talk a little bit about the implications for food and consumer safety that we are going to be seeing as a result of these increased light speeds and the paucity of USDA inspectors.
Well, I think we'll start where you ended, right? So the thing we start on is there's already a shortage of USDA inspectors, and they're incredibly understaffed. And a few of my inspectors, I mean, on average, they're working 6 days a week. The inspector that we'll talk about a few minutes, I mean, he's been working 7 day weeks. I mean, they're already spread really, really thin. So, you know, they're that thin line between coming out of a plant that treats human beings and animals, obviously, as you know, these externalities and the environment as well. Like they're the one thing that's keeping that from your dinner plate. Mm-hmm. And I should say, though, you know, I think at the very least, you'll be receiving a product of lower quality that you'll be paying the same or more for with high speed slaughter new inspection programs, right? Yeah. So that would be like, okay, that's the, you know, we know that now inspectors are no longer looking for the cosmetic defects, things that are gross maybe but won't kill you. So they've been moved, you know, that's the plant workers are supposed to be looking for those. So you can anticipate and expect some deviation in quality just based off of that. I would think that's fair to say. But that on the worst case scenario is that you're looking for sort of a degradation of the whole system where quality control is not at a premium. And basically the cops are off the beat, right? Mm-hmm. And so now you've got a privatized meat industry. We know from Upton Sinclair in the jungle, why we need regulation in the meat industry. We know that when you give them an inch, they take a mile. We know that even, you know, into the 90s, we've had incredibly deadly meat pathogens in E. coli with Jack in the Box. So we know that this isn't ancient history. We know that the meat industry is primed for that. I mean, that they can in fact be producing a lot of dangerous material in the form of hamburgers, right? Or pork chop. So, but then you want to look at this and say, well, maybe nothing's happening today. Maybe now, if I can see, you know, well, maybe we're trying to make this better for the meat industry. They've been playing ball pretty well. Well, don't forget, not too long ago, in a lot of people's, if I'm just mentioning the Westland Hallmark case, largest beef recall in history.
Yep.
That was a plant that was bulldozing downer cows into your food supply. That food was destined for the school lunch program. That was a biggest recall in history. That's just a few years ago. So yeah. this industry is far from operating without a net, right? I mean, we know that it requires people. I mean, just a quick little jaunt into this. I mean, having a meat inspector, which is a third party overseeing your processes, making sure that the meat is wholesome and safe, also adds a level of authority within the plant that, quite frankly, goes crazy with human rights abuses. I mean, like the stuff that we hear about women and sexual harassment in these plants. One of the more recent ICE raids, what it stemmed from women making sexual harassment and rape claims inside of a poultry plant. And that was in Mississippi. So meat inspectors add a certain authority, like a governmental presence, into what, left on its own devices, is a slaughterhouse. It's actually a slaughterhouse. So, you know, I mean, again, best case scenario, you get really gross things in your food. Worst case scenario, you don't see those gross things, and they make their way to your stomach and you can get quite sick from them.
Or die.
I mean, in the case of beef, and that's, I don't know if you know, not to cut you off, but Katie, you do know that they're looking at granting their first beef high-speed waiver. That should scare the pants off of them.
I did not know that.
Yes, they did. Yeah. So that inquiry has started. So they've already moved into beef, and that's it. You know, that's the most dangerous food there is when it comes to, foodborne pathogens like E. coli 0157, right? Which is deadly. And and if you're doing that high speed,
And it's hard to imagine it any higher speed than it is. I mean, I am one of probably very few Americans who have been inside a large scale Cargill processing plant, which, you know, state of the art, no expense spared. And that's why I got to see it. But these people are processing 4,000 cattle per day in a 16-hour time frame, and the next 8 hours are used to clean the plant. So, and that is, as I say, absolutely the state-of-the-art plant. So, you know, the idea that they're going to, you know, up the ante there and do 6,000 cattle a day, people, in 16 hours, or 8,000 in 16 hours, is just breathtaking. So on that note, let us take a very short break and come right back with Amanda Hitt. We're going to talk about her latest whistleblower case, a man named Anthony Vallone, who came into her office or practice to talk about a specific Tyson plant in Waterloo, Iowa, I guess it is. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Amanda Hitt.
This episode is brought to you by Appeal. Here at Heritage Radio Network, we care about reducing waste across our food system, from farms to home kitchens. We know that about half of the produce we grow ends up in the trash. We all want to enjoy produce at peak freshness and reduce the amount that gets thrown away. That's where Appeal comes in. Appeal is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. It's edible, invisible, and imitates how peels naturally protect fruits and vegetables. Because here's the thing, less waste doesn't just mean we're throwing less food away. It also means we waste less water, energy, and other resources that go into growing produce. Appeal works with nature to reduce waste across the food system, from the farm to the kitchen. Appeal helps us conserve our precious resources to ensure we have fresh food to meet our growing need. Appeal, food gone good. Learn more at appeal.com.
The Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture will be hosting their annual Young Farmers and Cooks Conference virtually this year on December 8th through 10th. Programming will cover topics like mutual aid, regional grain economies, land management practices, and much, much more. Whether you're a farmer, cook, butcher, miller, preservationist, processor, or anyone else in the food chain, this conference is for you. Learn more at stonebarncenter.org/YFCC.
So, again, back to slaughterhouse. I mean, you know, this stuff does really make my blood boil, Amanda. So let's talk about your case. So you have just taken on a new whistleblower in the pork inspection sector. Tell us about his lawsuit.
So Anthony came to us. He was actually a meat inspector at a high-speed plant, one of the pilot plants, and he came forward with disclosures about dangers inherent in the high-speed plants. But mostly his concerns were that maybe the data was potentially inaccurate, the safety data. His initial disclosures, that's how I met Anthony, was with that disclosure. And he was joined by a woman named Jill Maurer, who's also an inspector at that plant. But Anthony, well, just like so many of us, saw the news about a plant in a Tyson pork plant in Waterloo, Iowa, where this is just so reprehensible. They were betting on how many workers would get COVID. So
unbelievable.
It was unbelievable. You know, when Anthony read that article, he was incensed. But he was not. I guess he was incensed not because this one plant did this, but this has been going on in many of the plants that he visits. So he inspects several different plants. And one of the plants that he used to inspect was that very same Waterloo plant. Wow. So he was familiar with it. And, you know, the stories he had to tell about Waterloo were upsetting. I mean, the way he described it was just sort of an overcast, a gloominess and a sadness. And that while most plants do not treat workers well, there was a higher level of disparagement, higher contempt for the workers at Waterloo, was sort of a viciousness and also a lack of concern about the surrounding community too and the affected populations. People that lived, you know, lived and worked in those plants, just a lot of inherent sort of, you know, a lot of the, I mean, the problems that we face nationally, but really magnified there and under those circumstances. So he had explained that, but what really bothered him is that he didn't think that the American public really understood how these plants reacted to COVID and how they saw workers who got COVID and how, not just, you know, how we talked about their failure to respond quickly at first or do much to mitigate, you know, or mitigate the spread of COVID, but all, you know, by means of social distancing and PPE and hand washing stations, et cetera, but also the way that they generally cast COVID as being kind of, and I don't know how another way to say it, like an STD, like.
Really?
Yeah. He said that they sort of joke, like the general feeling in these pork plants was that it was basically like an STD, like herpes or mono. It's like something you get when you're dirty. It was just a very glib and disconnected from the human experience.
Dehumanizing is what I would call it.
Exactly. It's just getting mono. You deserve, not kind of like you deserve it, but that's what you get. You know what I mean? You got the Rona. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So stuff like that, joking like that. And he just thought it, you know, he just had enough. And he was like, you know, I just don't think people understand how these workers are just generally disregarded as a general rule, but also that the lack of real and genuine concern about disease spread from the plants especially, but then really, and he was also concerned too that, you know, his employer is not the plant. His employer is the USDA. And, you know, USDA wasn't doing a lot to really step in early on. I don't know if you know this, but early on with COVID, you know, USDA inspectors were also not using PPE. And the reason they were told not to use it was because it alarmed and scared the plant workers.
I see.
So the meat inspector was alerted to the risk.
Right.
And took precautions to protect him or herself. That would alert the workers. So think about that. You don't want to startle the natives. You know what I mean? So it's just a terrible, terrible culture that really, again, it's in such sharp relief when magnified by the COVID experience.
Absolutely. And has Anthony, first of all, has he had to step down from his position at the USDA? Has he suffered any pushback from USDA or retaliation? Or are they kind of letting him go forward with this whistleblower suit? You know, what I mean, usually your people get retaliated against, as far as I can tell.
Well, they generally do. Anthony's case was kind of unique. He had become so dissatisfied with these high-speed plants, the pilot that he was in. He had actually, before he blew the whistle, he had made a move. Like he had moved to a traditional plant without the high speeds. Mm-hmm. So that is what he was able to do, which kind of got him out of the spotlight and put him into a place where he was pretty much an unknown. Now he was on NBC. So, I mean, his face was showed. I mean, you know, I guess news didn't really follow him into his new plant. And so he didn't suffer any overt retaliation. Now he's speaking up again, and we have to keep an eye on him, and we'll monitor him. And should something happen, we'll be there to support him. Mm-hmm. As of yet, no. But usually it takes, you know, they're usually smart enough not to do it right away, right after you go public. Look a little suspicious. But, you know, that's why we're in there for the long haul with these whistleblowers. It's not, you know, we're a nonprofit. So, you know, we are lawyers. We are employment lawyers. And that is, you know, the nature of what we do. But the nature of our larger sort of one-stop shop for whistleblowing is that we're with you long after the litigation is over. And we're with you in supporting your advocacy thereafter, your activism, whatever you end up doing, or even staying in your position. Some people are committed to working to better the agencies or the systems from within. That's beautiful. But you know what? You need to have solidarity. You need to have the support, not only of legal counsel, which we are, but every whistleblower we get, we sort of shroud in a community of people who care. Not too long ago, we had our 10-year anniversary, and at that conference, you could really see it truly does. It takes a lot of people supporting the assertions of these whistleblowers to give them the validity, I guess, you know, and to add to their validity, I guess. One of the things that I routinely talk about is, you know, whistleblowers will blow the whistle. They'll speak truth to power. But a lot of times these other organizations come in and they video truth to power, right? They record truth to power. Mm-hmm. And that vindicates our whistleblowers. Well, we need an army of people willing to support these whistleblowers. And that's why it's not just litigation. It's not just legal representation. It's a long-term engagement with these folks and supporting them as they go forward trying to make the change that they sought in the beginning by making the disclosures.
Right.
I should say, and you know, since we've got a little bit of time, one of the things that I can't express enough. I just think it's always worth repeating. People think about whistleblowers and sometimes they'll have thoughts like, oh, it must be some sort of like a rat or a leak or something of that nature, mm-hmm. a troublemaker, right? Something like that. I should mention that, you know, there was a study done and well over, I think it was like 88% of all whistleblowers report internally before going public. And Anthony is not different. Anthony didn't just hear about Waterloo and pipe up or learn that there was all these people that were opposing high-speed slaughter and decide to pipe up. No, I mean, he's been blowing the whistle internally. Like, he has been raising concerns to his management, raising concerns to the USDA. It's only after these whistleblowers fully exhaust all internal means of making the difference that do they seek legal counsel or make the decision to reach out to the media or Congress.
Very interesting. So now what will be the next steps for Anthony Vallone when it comes to processing his complaint? How will that unfold?
Well, I mean, everything will just unfold as it is with the disclosure. And in a perfect scenario, he will be able to have spoken his truth without retaliation. The question becomes, you know, should retaliation occur, then what's the next step after that? And that almost invariably requires some sort of litigation redress, right? I mean, because at that point, if there's retaliation, there's going to be harm to that individual, personnel. You know, there's going to be a prohibited personnel practice. So cutting overtime or, you know, treating differently, giving bad positions or less desirable positions, just to name a few. But the biggest one, of course, is you know, termination.
Right.
And very often whistleblowers will come to us after they've had that retaliation, after they've had that termination. But I think it's an important thing to mention. You don't have to wait until you get retaliated against. It probably a good idea if you're thinking about blowing the whistle to talk to a lawyer, because there are safer and better ways to blow the whistle, and there are ways to do it and preserve your position. Sometimes, not all the time, but often you can do it in a safer way to just mitigate again some of the ramifications for truth telling. You know, in a perfect world, there wouldn't be any retaliation for truth telling. But I hate to say it. I think that, you know, that laughter's a stall, right? Like, we have so many people who come forward, and they, you know, they really get it handed to them. You know what I mean? They really suffer. It can be ostracizing. You know, people not talking to you. You almost become like a persona non grata. You know, people laugh at you, call you names. I mean, it's very childish on some level, but then sometimes it can be downright deadly. There was a whistleblower before she came to us. She had blown the whistle, and people don't think about this, but a lot of these slaughter plants, they're company towns. You kind That's of alluded right. to that, you know. So it's the only game in town. It's the biggest employer. And if you go messing around with somebody's employer, when that's the only employer in town, well, that whistleblower can get a pretty big, you know, X on his or her back pretty quick. And I knew of a woman who she blew the whistle, and it was on a slaughterhouse, and they smashed in her mailbox. They sat out in front of her, you know, they drove up to her yard, you know, and threw beer cans in her yard, called her pig, all kinds of names. So, I mean, it can be everything from schoolyard bullying to real threats of violence. So it's not nothing. It's certainly right. nothing.
Yeah, yeah. So just for the fun of it, because we only have a couple minutes left, talk about how do you think the new administration is going to address some of these industrial excesses? I mean, you know, even though Obama managed with great difficulty to pass the Food Safety Modernization Act, otherwise known as FSMA, not a lot changed as far as I can tell. A lot of the measures that he signed into law somehow were never fully implemented. So what do you think Biden's administration should focus on once he has, you know, kind of put out the current fires that he has to deal with? I mean, is it like breaking up monopolies or pursuing more vigorous worker safety legislation or increasing wages and benefits? I mean, where do you see this administration coming down when it comes to dealing with some of these egregious and, as you pointed out, now brought out to light via COVID, you know, some of these more egregious practices?
Well, I think, you know, this is great that we're having this conversation about line speeds, because, you know, busting the monopolies, probably not going to happen. I mean, maybe, I guess. But, you know, no one's anticipating that this Biden administration is going to just come out really heavy swinging. I don't think that's what the nation really wants. You know what I mean? I don't think that's what this election was about either. I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one that anticipates, maybe not like a big axe, you know, or a heavy sledgehammer approach. But I think, again, this conversation's very germane to this administration, because line speeds are something very much they can work on. They can do a lot, because that's USDA. That's the executive branch. So it's not like you got to write a new law or anything. You need to, I'll tell you what he needs to do. Stop this crap with line speeds and beef right now. It's got to stop. And that's easy. You know, that's not that. That's something you can do right away. Stop the poultry rule. Like, you know, start keeping your promise to America's workers too. Start demanding that OSHA listen to these complaints, and, you know, by God, do something about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are things that you don't have to have congressional consensus. You know what I mean? These are just things that. Good regulatory practice. Put some law and order back into this agency. Start getting these line speeds. Square those away. Stop it in beef entirely. And there's room to stop it in poultry as well. And we don't know what we were supposed to learn during the waiver time. That waiver period was supposed to be an opportunity for us to learn more about, you know, worker injuries in with these high line speeds. Well, we haven't gotten a full test of that. We don't really know, because we haven't been running the line speeds because of COVID. So there's a lot there. It's tricky, but it's not impossible, and it's not beyond the scope of this election, if you know what I mean. It's not, you know, he's not Teddy Roosevelt here. You know what I mean?
right.
It's just a matter of putting some order back into a very chaotic world that is the meat industry in general, but specifically for those who work in slaughter plants. It's a dangerous place to work, and our country, we're better than that. We're better than that. We can do more for America's workers.
God, I hope you're right. And with that, I'm going to ask you to promote the Food Integrity Campaign. Where can people learn more about what you're doing and how they can support it?
Check us out at foodwhistleblower.org. We've got lots of resources there for you, whether you're blowing the whistle yourself or want to help someone speak truth to power.
Thank you so much, Amanda. Have a great holiday season. It's a joy and a delight as always. And we'll be talking again very soon, I have no doubt. Listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. And many thanks to my sponsor, as always, for supporting Heritage Radio Network. See you next week, folks. Have a good one.
What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.